most of the psukim that we're working with at the start are from this parak Lamed Aleph, chapter 31 of Tehillim, which deals with David pleading with God for help. And you could really break down this chapter that you have on the sheet in front of you in source number 1 into 4 parts. The first part, sentences 1 to 9, and you can just do a quick read through it, is David expressing great faith in Hashem. So he turns to God and he says, I've taken refuge in you, you are my rock, you are my fortress, you lead me, you guide me. Into your hand I commit my spirit. I hate those who regard lying vanities, but I trust in God. And so on. It's an expression of emunah, an expression of faith. Sentences 10 to 18 are a plea to Hashem, saying, Hashem, save me, because I have been harmed by the world, I have been humiliated by the world, and you can see it. I'm looking at Pasuk Yud Bet, sentence 12. Because of all of my adversaries, I have become a reproach. I am forgotten as a dead man out of mind. I am like a useless vessel. I have heard the whispering of many, terror on every side. Right, but I trust you, Hashem. You're going to be the one to save me. Okay, that's the second part of this. The third part is a plea to Hashem, and this is where it gets particularly interesting, sentences 18 to 21. Let's read that. Again, this is the JPS translation. O God, let me not be ashamed, for I have called upon you. Let the wicked be ashamed, let them be put to silence in the netherworld. The sentences I underlined are the ones that the Medrash is going to quote. Let the lying lips be dumb, which speak arrogantly against the righteous with pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is your goodness, which you have laid up for those who fear you, which you have wrought for them who take their refuge in you, in the sight of the sons of men. You hide them in the cover of your presence from the plottings of man. You conceal them in a pavilion from the strife of tongues. So he says, Hashem, help the righteous who trust you, and harm the wicked who do not. That's the third part of this paragraph, chapter of Tehillim, and he concludes the last few sentences with a call to the righteous to trust Hashem, because after all, Hashem helped me. Okay, so those are the four parts of this parak. First, expressing great faith. Second, pleading with God, save me. Third, asking Hashem to help the righteous who trust in him and to harm the wicked who do not. And then finally, calling upon the righteous to trust in God. Those are the four parts. Now, when you look at the lines I underlined in the English, those are the ones, again, that this Medrash is going to jump on. You see the Hebrew for it in source number 2. Disregard for the moment which words I underlined. That's going to matter soon, but not yet. Te'alamna sifsei sheker. Let the lips that lie, the lips of falsehood, let them become mute. Right? Elaim is one who is mute. Hadovros al tzaddik asak, which speak asak or atak against the tzaddik. What is atak? That's a very hard word. They render it here in the English, you see, as arrogance. Right? Speak arrogantly, but we're going to have to come back to that word. Begava vavuz. In arrogance, or now they're stuck because they already said arrogantly, so they use pride, and contempt. In contrast, he says, how great is your goodness that you have stored away, tzafanta like tzafun, that you have stored away for those who are in awe of you, pa'alta lechosim bach neged bnei adam, which you do for those who trust you before the eyes of man. Okay, you are going to take care of them in front of everybody else. So, a literal read is of these two sentences is, may those who speak badly about the tzaddik be struck dumb. How great is the goodness you have stored away for those who are in awe of you. You're going to also provide goodness for them not only in the future, but even in this world in front of those who mock them. Right? So far so good? Relatively straightforward at this stage. The Medrash is bothered by at least 3 things in these 2 psukim. 3 things bother the Medrash. Now, I underlined this. I'm faced with a challenge when I come to make up a source sheet. I want the sheet to be clear enough that people afterwards will be able to use it as a reference to reconstruct the shir. But that means telegraphing things in advance. So I can't ask you now, what are the 3 words in the pasuk? So let's look at the three words which are obviously the source of the problem and figure out what it is that's the problem. The first is te'olamna. Te'olamna is an unusual word. In and of itself, the grammatic structure is normal. It's they, feminine. Okay, that's what gives you the tough in the beginning and the na at the end. They feminine, and it's a future thing. This should happen to the lips that speak falsely. The verb in the middle of it, aleph lamed mem, to be mute, is also a word you find in Torah. That's not in and of itself difficult. Hashem speaks to Moshe and he says, mi yasum ilem, who is it who makes people mute? It's a term that we see. It does appear in Tehillim somewhat, such as in Perek Lamed Tes. But this is the point raised by the Eitz Yosef. It's not nearly as common as another word for silence that appears in Tehillim. Maybe. Shin Kuf Tet is certainly a term that we're familiar with. There's another term that's even more popular. The Eitz Yosef makes note of it. The verb domu, or nidmu, or dumiya, or yidmu, comes up in all sorts of uses in Tehillim. That's a much more common verb. And so one thing that the Medrash is going to pick up on is this use of te'olamna. By choosing this verb, instead of choosing dumiya, some form of that, tidmena perhaps, the Medrash perhaps, the pasuk perhaps, is giving me an additional message. Yes?
Doesn't it have a different connotation, a little bit like lidom is like to keep silent, whereas Elaine is sort of like, isn't it like more like somebody who's mute, not by choice?
Could be. Hang on to that thought. It's a good thought.
Is te'olem, is like, I think what struck me and why when I looked at the Hebrew word, I thought to myself, if I hadn't seen the translation, I would have no clue what that means. Is it common, like, Elaine is a noun, but I don't remember ever seeing it used as a verb.
It's true. It actually, I'm not expert enough in Tehillim to say it never appears as a verb. It could be that it does. But it's unusual to begin with. But it's a good question. The second word that troubles us, I'm now jumping in source number two, to the last. It's the last of the three that I underlined, is the word atak. That is a very strange word, so much so that the Mefarshim struggle with it. If you take a look at source number four, you see what Rashi does, and Malvin brings this as well. Rashi says, Atak is Sarah, Samach Resh Hei. He's thinking of Ki Diber Sarah Al Hashem Elokeichem, somebody who speaks against Hashem. So, Davar She'eino, it means something that is not. That's what Sarah means. Kimo vayatek misham. He's giving you another use of the word ayin tafkuf, where it means to travel. It's talking about Abraham and Sarah traveling. Vayatek misham. So he says it means, I gave you the best I could do in the English, that which leads astray. Something which is not true, davar she'eino, and leads people astray like they're traveling, and he traveled from there, vayatek. V'dunash pasar oso, dunash meaning dunash ibn labrat, the grammarian Rashi often quotes, he says, dunash explained it, lashon davar gadol v'kasha, atak would mean a great and tough thing, kimo, and he gives you a pasuk, atku v'gam gavru chayol, they grew large and gained strength in Eov. Generally speaking, when you have a word in Tanakh that looks entirely unfamiliar, it's good to say, well, yeah, there's a word in Eov like that, because there probably is. Eov is very hard, just in terms of the language. So, Rashi offers us two explanations of atak, right? To lead astray, or to say a great and tough thing. He's bothered, because this is not a word that we encounter frequently. It's certainly not used in this way. And that's our second problem. Our third problem in the pasuk is not about translating a word, but it's about content. And I underlined the word tzaddik. What should trouble us, and that's why I brought the entire chapter of Tehillim here, what should trouble us about the use of this term tzaddik in this chapter? not simple, but if you look at it in context, you'll see it.
Could it be that he's, when you, if you go back to the Pasuk, where he says that how everyone's talking against him, is he referring to him? It's almost, is David HaMelech referring to himself as a tzaddik?
What would bother us about that?
It's not like him.
Okay. More than that? It's a good starting point, but more than that?
It's Gaiva. That in itself is Gaiva.
True. But more than that. How has David described himself in this parak?
Right. As a dead person, as a forgotten, useless.
Right, I mean, looking through it, how does David describe himself? Has David claimed any sort of merit for himself? The answer is yes, but what is it?
That he trusts Hashem.
Right. David's merit is the fact that he trusts Hashem, and he repeats it several times over. Right? The you are my rock and my fortress. He says, I have trusted in you. I said, you are my God. Right? I have called upon you. David's sole claim in this chapter, in terms of his own merit, is, I trust God. Now, that's a magnificent trait. But is it one that's going to warrant calling himself tzaddik? The answer is probably not. And that's the third point that bothers the Medrash.
Especially because he says, my strength fails because of my iniquity.
Yeah, I'm sinful. Hello. Right? Sentence 11. It sure doesn't sound like he's calling himself a tzaddik. Who does he call a tzaddik in this parak? There is someone he identifies. I didn't bring you the Hebrew. I only brought you the English just for reasons of space. But you can tell as you read it.
But he said his merit that let me not be ashamed, for I have called upon you.
Right. That's my merit, is the fact that I call upon God. That doesn't make me righteous. But who is righteous?
Hashem's wondrous loving kindness.
Better, more explicit. Sorry. Sentence 2. In you, O God, have I taken refuge. Let me never be ashamed. Deliver me in your righteousness. God is the one who is described as being righteous. So how would that make sense in sentence 19? So that's what I think triggers our Medrash. Our Medrash looks at a parak of Tehillim, which could be read simply as yet another parak in which David says, I'm in a lot of trouble. Hashem, I trust you. Please save me. Help the righteous. Reward them and punish the wicked. And now everybody call upon God. And the Medrash sees, number one, use of the word Te'alamna, which is strange. Number two, the use of the word Atak, which is also strange. And number three, it's unclear who this tzaddik is in this parak. You know, we think about the number of times that we say Tehillim, whether as part of davening or people who recite Tehillim, you know, as a matter of course. Do we ever stop and pay attention to the psukim in what really is the form of iyun, of analyzing a pasuk, the way that somebody sitting and learning Gemara is going to break down a Gemara, or someone sitting and studying the Rambam is going to say, why did the Rambam use this word, and why did he do it in this way, in this order, and so on. The Medrash is saying every word in Tehillim matters, and we have to understand why it is the way it is, what are we meant to learn from it, and that brings us to our Medrash at long last. So I broke the Medrash up in my translation into three parts, and I felt that would make it work better. The first part is simply tackling Te'olamna, and that's source number 5 on your sheet. Rav Huna b'shem bar kapara Pasach. Te'olamna sifsei sheker. Okay, Rav Huna started out, he opened, we've seen that verb before. He opens the lesson with the quote from Tehillim, Te'olamna sifsei sheker. Lips of falsehood should be made elame. In the English here, I use the word elame. I did the italics, the transliteration. Is parchan is harshan ishtatkan. They should be crumbled, deafened, and silenced. Meaning, elame doesn't just mean to be deaf. It means more than that. Where do you get that association? is parchan and is harshan, crumbled and deafened. So the first one we're going to tackle is the deaf one. Heich madat omar, like when you say, O mi yasum ilemo chirei shopikeach oiver, hello anochi Hashem, right? When Moshe protests to God, he says, I can't really speak well, don't send me. Hashem says, I'm familiar. He says, O mi yasum ilem, he says, who has the power to make somebody mute? O chereish, or deaf, O pikeach, or someone who is sighted, O iver, or blind. Hello anochi Hashem, I am God. The Medrash is picking up on, and the Eitz Yosef explains it. Did I bring it on your sheet? Yeah, I did. If you take a look at source number 9. Vayomer Hashem Elav, he quotes the pasuk that we just referenced, Misam Pela Adamo Miyasum Ilem O Cheresh, but what he quotes is the opening part. Who gives man a mouth? Right? Which we didn't quote in the actual Medrash, but he says that matters. Because now you understand that there should be an opposition in here. Mi sam pela adam? Who gives someone a mouth? O mi asum ilaim? Or who makes somebody mute? Right? And then, O pikeach? Who makes somebody able to see? O iver? Or blind? But in the middle, you have the word ilaim. The word cheresh, excuse me, of the word cheresh, that doesn't seem to fit. So the Eitz Yosef continues. You should have Eitz Yosef in there. I think that edition has Eitz Yosef, so you can actually see the original there. It should be Aleph Hey. Oh, you want Parsha Aleph. That's why. You want Parsha Aleph and Paragraph Hey. Yeah. Yeah. One day we may be in Parsha Hey. So he says, Demidaloka Amar Nami O Miyasum Ozen O Cheresh. The word Cheresh means deaf. But it didn't say, or who gives someone an ear or makes him deaf, the parallel opposition. Lios Gamkein Davarve Hifucho, so that you'd have the opposite. Klape Acheresh Simas Haozen. So that opposite of the Cheresh, the deaf one, you would have the giving of an ear. Elavadai. The answer must be that deaf is also opposite who has given man a mouth. In other words, the way to look at the pairs is who gives someone a mouth or who makes them mute or deaf? Who makes someone able to see or blind? So being able to speak is opposite muteness and deafness. Now, how does that work? So he explains. Ba'achi Kamar, this is what it's saying. Misam pela adam, who gives someone a mouth? O miyasum ne'edar koach hapeh, or who will make somebody unable to speak? Vizem mishnei panim, and there will be one of two sources for it. And this goes back to your point about the use of ilaim in particular. He says, O ilaim b'tiv o, she'en lo koach hadibur, either someone who is naturally mute, he can't speak, O cheresh, or he's deaf, kim eno shamaya eno medaber, because if he can't hear, he can't speak. So you're right, nidmu would have been more somebody keeping himself silent as an act of will. The ilaim is someone who's unable to speak, whether unable to speak because he doesn't have the power of speech, or unable to speak because he can't hear what he's saying, and therefore he never is trained in forming words, being able to converse. So the Medrash is picking up on, aside from giving us a lesson in Tehillim, it's giving us a lesson in this pasuk in Hashem's conversation with Moshe. Because, frankly, I've been reading that pasuk for years and years and years, and I never thought about the fact that the parallelism is off. You know, you have the parallel for the mute, you have the parallel for the blind, and you don't have a parallel for the deaf. So I thought that was very interesting.
In the case of Moshe, it wasn't the case, actually.
Not for Moshe personally, no.
But personally, he was not full of hearing, but he had a speech impediment.
Correct. Correct. It has, Hashem is simply making a statement that he's the one who gives people their ability to function. The first message here, going back now to source number 5, is Te'olamna means deafened, because now Elaim, we understand, doesn't just mean unable to speak, but it also means to be deaf, and And then he continues to explain how it means crumble, these parchan, v'omer. He quotes you the pasuk from Bereishis. V'hine anachnu me'alamim alumim besoch ha'sadeh, v'hine kama alumasi, right? Yosef's dream. So he describes them binding the sheaves in the field. The word alumim is used for the sheaves. Ordinarily, when we read that in the Torah, if someone says, well, you know, doesn't ilay mean mute? The answer is, yeah, it does, but there's no connection. But the Medrash says, yes, there is. What is it? V'hine kama alumasi, the sheaves crumble. Alumim is understood as a term for the sheaves that are falling apart. And so the idea is, te'alam nosif se sheker, their lips should crumble. And then the last one is ishtatkan, they should be silenced, and that's what ilam normally means, to be rendered mute. So that's the normal meaning. So the first part of the Medrash says that when David says, te'alam nosif se sheker, that these lips should be muted, he means utterly destroyed. It means muted, deafened, crushed. That's what he wants to see happen to these people. Now at this point I'm wondering, what have they done? That's
wait,
so horrible.
Isn't it that he wants the lips?
Yes.
So he's talking about people or lips? Or?
Well, it's the lips of the people.
Okay.
I mean, I tend to think this is the person's fate, especially because deafened isn't something that can happen to lips. Although as a result of deafness, they may become mute, as we're seeing here. To me, this is a statement of utter destruction, that they should no longer be able to say whatever horrible thing it is that they are saying. So, what is it that they are saying? So that brings us to source number 6, the second part of the Medrash. And here we find out that indeed Tzaddik is not a reference to David at all. Hadovros al Tzaddik, they speak against or upon the righteous one. Chei ha'olamim, that's a reference, or Chei ha'olamim perhaps, the eternal one, the one who lives forever. Atak, that term atak that we saw that we could not properly translate, that Rashi gave it his best shot on. Shehe'etik, we have in our edition bivriyosav, other editions have mibriyosav. That which God moved away from his creations, which God removed from his creations. Remember the pasuk that Rashi quoted in source number something? Source number 4, thank you. The first one he had, bayatek, to lead astray, to go away from, right? So he says, atak, they speak about something that God removed. These wicked people, what's so horrible about them? What is that they're saying that David wants eliminated? They are speaking about that which Hashem removed from his creations. There's something Hashem didn't want us to talk about, and they are talking about it.
Himself?
No.
Righteous with pride and pathetic.
Hang on. We're getting there. They're speaking about something that they're not supposed to be talking about. So now I want to know. That's the first thing I want to know. When someone's speaking Lashon Hara, so what are they saying? what is this horrible thing that they're talking about, that David wants them to be so destroyed and unable to speak at any rate? So the Medrash continues. The pasuk said they speak big ga'ava. They speak with arrogance. Asmaha. It's shocking that they would do this. Bishvil his ga'os. In order to be arrogant. Velomar. And just to say, ani doresh b'maseh bereishis. These are people who want to say, we know it all. We know the secrets of the universe. And therefore they speak of creation as though they knew what happened. That's where we are in the Medrash. We have to come back to this line, obviously, but that's what the Medrash is saying, that the horrible thing that they are doing is speaking about that which God concealed. God simply said, I made this day one, this day two, and so on and so on, and they are walking around talking about it as though they knew what all the things were that I didn't make mention of in the days of Bereishis. Keep on reading first, and then we have to come back to this. Vavuz, and with scorn. Asmaha, once again, it's shocking. Mivaze al kivodi. He's degrading my honor, my capital M, the honor of God. Da amar Yosi bar Chanina, for Yosi bar Chanina said, Kol ha-miskabed beklon chavero, ein lo chelak l'olam haba. If a person makes his own honor, his own reputation, out of mocking others, he has no share in the next world. So, b'chvodo shel makom, alachas kama v'kama. How much more so if he's going to make his fortune by degrading and mocking Hashem. Umaksiv acharav, and then the next pasuk in Tehillim says what? Ma rav tuvcha asher tzafanta lirayacha. How great is your goodness that you have stored away for those who are in awe of you. The ones who are in awe, lirayacha, v'lo lebozim es moracha harav. Those who are in awe of you, not the ones who scorn your great reverence. Al yehi be ma rav tuvcha. Those people will not be included in this great goodness that you're saving. So, the Medrash says, Atak is that which God removed, and the Tzaddik is Hashem, and what they are doing is they are speaking about God in God's creation, and that's considered to be disrespectful. Clear so far? What's the message, though? What does that mean? Does that mean that are we in fact saying that for a person to try to analyze and say this is what was there before creation, or for a person to say this is how Hashem created, right? If a person is going to study Big Bang Theory or whatever the theory of the day is going to be, are they now guilty of the sin that David is identifying here? Are they now in that category? Is it only if they do it out of arrogance? Maybe if they do it in another way, they're all right? What exactly is wrong with doing this? And if you're really going to tell me that, well, it's because Hashem chose not to describe it, there are an awful lot of things that are left out of Torah Shebichtav. Right? The written Torah is missing a whole lot because Hashem didn't see fit to include it. So does that mean now that any time I want to describe something that happened, I'm guilty?
But then some of it is included in the Torah Shabbat. So.
True. Well, that's actually a perfect question then. That's the lead into the question. We did a medrash a few weeks ago in which we learned about the creation of the malachim, which aren't mentioned there. And we said, well, we can deduce from Tehillim, they're created on day 5 or they're created on day 2. You know, maybe that's something we're not supposed to be discussing at all. Who gave Torah Shabbat Peh?
Well, the difference is that if you're looking into the psukim and trying to derive from the Torah itself in order to increase your awe of Hashem, that's one thing. Whereas if you're taking some outside source, which may or may not have any Yirat Shamayim to it, and then trying to paste it onto the Torah and say, well, that must be what the Torah is saying.
Right.
Yeah. I think also it's not so much, we've never been held back from trying to understand even chukim, something that we always try to do and people are encouraged to do in Yiddishkeit. But the bottom line is that there is an acceptance that there are certain things that we'll never know, and that's okay. And if we try to understand something and then it turns out that it's not right, that's fine. We were just trying to understand it. Hashem knows. There's just an acceptance that there are some things that we will never know. We try to understand as much as we can, and if not...
So that sounds like you would say it's about the attitude.
It's the approach. They do it in order to be arrogant, or in order to understand your Shemayim.
Maybe.
Could it be that they feel like they're on God's level if they figure out how to understand how creation happened?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think that I would definitely see that as a part of this, although it's not stated explicitly. I think it makes sense.
It's the before the base. It's trying to understand things that Hashem said. There's certain things before the base that we'll never understand.
Well, let's take a look. Take a look at number 7, because I think that seeing the third part of this medrash might change your spin a little bit. This is also same medrash still, but we get an allegory. Benoeg shebaolam, normally, melech baser v'dam bone paltin b'makom ha'bivim u'makom ha'ashpa u'makom ha'sirios. If a normal flesh and blood mortal king were to build a palace in a place of sewers, in a place of trash, in a place where things are decomposing, kol mishu balomar paltin zu benuya b'makom ha'bivim u'makom ha'ashpa u'makom ha'sirios eino pogim. If someone were to come along and say, that king's palace, I remember when that was landfill, right? If someone were to come along and say, where the king has his big royal hall where he greets important visitors, the pigs used to graze there, or whatever the term is for pigs do. They wallowed there. That would be insulting. Kach kol mishu ba lomar ha'olam hazeh nivra mitoch tohu vavohu eino pogim. So too, if someone were to say the world was created from tohu vavohu, would he not also be degrading creation? Asma, it's shocking that one could do that. We are rendering tohu vavohu, words which really we don't know how to translate, but someone in the Medrash does. We are rendering tohu and bohu as the equivalent of the sewer, the trash, the place of decomposition. And the idea is, when the Torah says "Va'aretz haisa sohu vavohu," that the world was a degraded place; it was a ruin, and it's insulting to say that that's what the world was like until Hashem changed things. And it continues to say, Rav Huda, or not really until Hashem changed things, because Hashem had to create the tohu and bohu first. But Rav Huna b'shem bar kapara omar ilulei shadavar kasuv yefshar la'omro. He said, if it were not written, you couldn't say it. Meaning, Bereishis bara Elokim, in the beginning, Hashem created minayin hein. Where did he create it from? V'aretz haisa sohu vavohu. The land was tohu and bohu. In other words, because there's a pasuk that says the land was tohu and bohu, you can say it. But you're not supposed to go any further with it. So this third part, to me, radically changed the Medrash. Is it really that you're not supposed to discuss creation at all? Or is there something else going on here? Sounds like the Chazon and Kahal are back in pictures. Is it really that you're not supposed to discuss creation?
It's in a judgmental way.
In a degrading way, right? In a way that's going to reduce its honor. And I stress that because of source number 11.
But what one would think, if you said that tohu vavohu is somehow in a negative thing, that only increases the power and glory of Hashem, saying that before creation, it was tohu vavohu.
Right. I wonder if that isn't... And I could be radically off base with this, but I wonder if that isn't a modern mindset. In other words, today, if someone said to me, you know that great big skyscraper? When they built that, you know, that was a horrible area, it was a slum, and now they made this beautiful, and so on and so on and so on. Like, I would look at that and say, that's an amazing transformation, kol hakavod, that you managed to do that.
The idea of makeover, you break the girl who looks horrendous, and you're like, wow!
No one looks horrendous. But maybe, I mean, the truth of the matter is, you could, if you wanted to, you could sort of connect this to the classic debate about whether it's better to be a tzaddik gamur or to be baal tshuva, whether it's better that you would never sin, or whether it's better that you actually grew out of something and became righteous. And that's a debate that has no resolution.
And yet you're not supposed to remind somebody of
where they came from.
So that,
right. That rings with what we're saying here. Yeah. So I think that if you were just to have our medrash, it would seem that the issue is not to speak degradingly about creation. But take a look at number 11, because this is a mission in Chagiga.
Can I just go back to that 7? Because when I heard you read that, I heard something completely different.
Okay.
I heard that it would be degrading ilulei, were it not for the fact that it says it in the Torah. So if it says it in the Torah, then it's not degrading. But we have to be so careful, I think that kind of goes back to what you're saying, like to only extract things that are from the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I was hearing what we said, rapo to rapé, that if it didn't say rapo to rapé, we wouldn't be able to use a doctor. You know, if it didn't say tohu vavohu, we couldn't ever, God forbid, say that we would never have the
right.
I'm just chutzpah, but right.
I'm not sure that we're meant to take that step, bless you, to say, and therefore you can say it.
That's what I understand.
I hear what you're saying, but I have a hard time with it. The Eitz Yosef on it simply quotes Rashi saying, "Afilu hayachal lahavino midato." Even if you could have figured that out on your own, lo haya Rashi legaloso, you would not have been entitled to reveal it.
Right, exactly. That supports what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If you think that you've used your intellect to say that the world came from tohu vavohu, that would be a chutzpah. The only reason we can say it is because Hashem said it.
Right.
It's because the Torah says it.
Right. No, I think that's so. I just, whether that means that I'm now entitled to say it came from,
You're not allowed to say Va'aretz Hayatov.
Well, you have to be allowed to say it. It's a pasuk.
Exactly.
But maybe I'm just, I'm saying that you can quote the pasuk, but you're not supposed to go any further.
Right.
Although that comes back to the point of, you can't go further because you don't have a source for it. If you had a source for it, then you could go further.
So, again, that goes back to your question.
Yeah.
Are you allowed to learn my separation? Are you allowed
right.
to sit and what exactly does Tohu Vavohu mean? Try and translate it.
Right.
I mean, we spent how many weeks on Tohu Vavohu with
the Olympics? We don't know anything still.
Take a look at number 11. I really want to get to it. The Mishnah and Chagiga. One who looks into four areas, it would be fitting, Rasui is like Ra'ui, it would be fitting that he had never come to the world. Malamalan, what is above? Malamatan, what is below? Malifnim, what came before? Umalachor, and what is coming after? Kol shalochaz akvod kono, Rasui lo kilu lo bala olam. One does not respect the honor of his creator, it would be better had he not entered the world. So there, is it about a tohu vavohu degradation? I don't think so. Right? This is not tohu vavohu anymore. This is, don't look into it because it's Hashem's honor that this is concealed. Right? To me, it seems that Chagiga, source number 11, is against investigating Bereishis, period. What you have in the Psukim, fine. What you have in Torah Shabbat Peh, fine. But you can't go any further at all, positive or negative. Whereas our Medrash, it seems to me, is fine with study that does not belittle. And all study does not necessarily belittle, because if all study belittled, the way the Chagiga says, then I wouldn't need the parable about the palace. Right? You wouldn't need the third part. The third part tells me that it's not about studying it, it's about degrading it. So I find that very interesting. I think we actually are seeing two conflicting sources on this.
And not to mention, all kinds of Gadol will spend volumes and volumes discussing it, so they can't all be called arrogant and...
Yeah, that's hard to do.
Well, just it also depends what he means by what they mean by above, below, before, and after. You know, are they talking about the essential Hashem that we can't possibly understand? What came, what came before creation? That's not just Bereishis, because it's also after. What's going to happen after?
Right.
After everything, after Yemos Mashiach, after Tzvias Amesim, after everything, we don't know anything.
Right.
But actually, we're asked in Pirkei Avot, we ask to dwell in it in order to sustain the modesty. You should understand where you come from, where you're going, who you are.
Right.
This is like the element us.
It is an element of modesty. So what we've done, just to make sure we understand how this fits into everything now, is in order to teach a lesson about Bereishis, we imported a lesson about Tehillim. We had these psukim in Tehillim with words that we didn't really understand, and that didn't seem to hold together this business about them degrading the tzaddik. And what we've said is that what David HaMelech was doing in Tehillim was complaining about those who speak with scorn regarding Hashem. That's what he has done there. Now, I want to come back to that in a few minutes, but I did want to first mention two things. If you look at sources 13 and 14, I didn't have room to put in the actual Midrashim that I wanted to quote. But I put it there just, that when you look at the sheet, you'll remember that we discussed it. Shmos Rabbah, Nun Beis Beis, which you actually may have in that one, Elaine, is also bothered by the use of tzaddik. And it uses two other approaches to explain it. One approach is fascinating. You know, there's a classic debate in the Gemara about what you should do on Yom Kippur as part of Vidui. If a person did Vidui last year, they admitted their sins, and they came before Hashem, and they apologized, and I'm never going to do it again. A year goes by. Next Yom Kippur, they're standing in, again in Shemona Esrei, and they want to do Vidui. Should they admit things from previous years? And one view is that one should, and the other view is absolutely not. It's considered like going back to the old sins, and one shouldn't do so. But the Medrash there has an interesting take on this. It says you shouldn't go back to repeating the, you shouldn't repeat the old sins, because it's like you're saying before Hashem, I don't have any new sins. I need to go back to the old ones. I needed to dredge up the old ones because I had nothing new to add. So it's as though the idea of speaking against Hashem, against the tzaddik, is that you're speaking against Hashem as though Yom Kippur didn't work for you last year, is part of this theme that's discussed there in the Medrash. And then they give another approach, which is tzaddik is Moshe. The people who spoke against Moshe when they built the Mishkan. If you remember the Midrashim about the allegations about Moshe at the time, that's another take on this. Our Midrash and Shmos Rabba are bothered by the same thing. What is this tzaddik? It's not David. So the question is then what is it? The other point that I wanted to make sure to mention is the Gemara in Bava Metzia. David here, if you take this pasuk in its most literal sense, is still speaking about those who falsely malign the righteous. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia says that you should be careful not to lend money without witnesses. Because if you lend money without witnesses, then when it comes time to collect, if the person you lent it to forgets about it, you're going to come up to him, he's a good guy, everybody knows him, and say, hey, you owe me money. And he's going to say, I don't know what you're talking about. And you are going to look like you are maligning a righteous person. And that will cause other people to then do to you what David invokes here. People are going to say, look at him. He speaks against the tzaddik. Te'alam nasif se shaker. Lips of falsehood should be rendered mute and crushed and so on. The Gemara says this is a warning to people. Don't put yourself in a position where you will look like you are falsely accusing the righteous. So that's another take on this. I bring it both because I find it interesting and because I think that it's worth seeing how the Chachamim dealt with these problems of what is being discussed in different ways. But one last note on this. If you go back again to the chapter of Tehillim in source number one, David has done something. If we take our Medrash, you know, leaving aside the other Midrashim that we now saw, Moshe Rabbeinu and so on, but if you take our Medrash's approach, what has David done in sentences 19 and 20 to add to the argument he gave previously in this chapter? Meaning, the opening part of the chapter was, we said, sentences 1 to 9, I express my great faith in Hashem. Then a plea to Hashem in sentences 10 to 18. God, save me. I've been harmed and shamed by the world. What happens now in 18 to 21? Starting with, let the wicked be ashamed. Let them be put to silence in the netherworld.
I was just going to ask you the same question.
So what has he done? Medrash to a rhythm. What David, I think, is doing is something we also do during davening. David has converted his enemies into enemies of Hashem. Right?
That's a theme throughout. Mm-hmm. Throughout Tehillim.
Absolutely.
You know, but he always says it's not me, it's that I'm representing Hashem. And anybody talks.
Well, what he's saying now is the people who scorn me, the people who mock me and are trying to harm me, these are also enemies of God. It's not simply that they attack me, but they also attack you in their arrogance. And therefore, even if I am not worthy of protection personally, because all I have going for me is that I trust in Hashem, but even if I'm not worthy, act against them for your sake. That's what David is putting in here in light of the Medrash. He says, they do this to me. I am forgotten as a dead man out of mind. I am like a useless vessel. I've heard the whispering of many, and so on. And then he says, these people who speak against you, Hashem, who speak, let the lying lips be dumb, which speak arrogantly against the righteous, capital R, right, with pride and contempt, let them suffer. And how abundant is your goodness, which you have laid up, which you have stored away for those who fear you. Us on the good team, the ones who revere Hashem, let Hashem take care of us. You know, sort of as a backdrop to this, it doesn't fit for the discussion right now, but every time you read in Tehillim, you know, David calling on Hashem to punish his enemies and to save him, keep in mind, this is not gratuitous. This isn't David saying, let all the bad people be hurt and I want lollipops. David Amelon's life is in danger. He's pleading for his life. He's on the run constantly from various people, whether it's that they want to delegitimize his throne and hand it to somebody else, and at which point he's dead, or whether it's people who are actively making war against him. This is what David is doing is not simply, God hurt the bad people, but what he's doing is God saved my life. So I think that's an important point to sort of keep in mind throughout. But this is... This is what I see here in this medrash. It's a medrash that through Tehillim teaches us a lesson about Bereishis and about looking at creation, since we're starting Sefer Bereishis here, looking at creation and what we're entitled to look at and what we're not. The view of this medrash being, you can analyze as long as you do it in a way that honors, not in a way that degrades. As opposed to the Chagiga one, which would seem to be against analysis altogether. Okay? We'll pick up with that, God willing, next week.